wanted to bury her either next to some water or next to some trees.
Why is that?
Because that's where I would like to be buried. If somebody had killed me, I would hope that they would bury me next to something nice. I just don't mean some dumpster.
Kenya Monhe was just 19 years old when she vanished after a night out with friends in Denver, Colorado, leaving her phone, purse, and keys behind. Our story begins on a chilly evening in March 2011 in downtown Denver, Colorado, where Kenya Monhe and her friends were out at the popular nightclub 24K. While the young women weren't 21 yet, they used fake IDs to gain entry and order alcoholic drinks at the club. As the night progressed, the teenagers reportedly became very intoxicated, and at some point, Kenya was separated from her friends. While some sources state that she'd been kicked out of the club, others claim she simply left to go to the restroom and never returned. Either way, Kenya ended up outside and alone, with all her personal belongings abandoned on a table inside the nightclub. Assuming she'd simply wandered off, Kenya's friends didn't think much of her absence, but they did collect her phone, purse, and keys before leaving the nightclub. However, the following day, alarm bells started to go off when Kenya was still nowhere to be found. The friends Kenya had been out with went to her parents' house to drop off her belongings and make sure she got home all right, but she wasn't there either. At first, Kenya's stepfather, Tony, thought it was all just a tasteless April Fool's joke, but upon seeing her cell phone, he knew something was very wrong. As with most teenagers, Kenya was rarely without her phone, and she definitely wouldn't have gone anywhere for an extended time without it, at least not willingly. Trying not to panic, Tony unlocked Kenya's phone and started looking for clues as to where she might be. But he stopped dead in his tracks when a strange text message came through to her phone from an unknown number. "Hey, this is Travis, the guy who gave you a ride last night. White creepy van. Did you get home okay?" Tony called the number repeatedly but got no response, so he and Kenya's mother made the decision to file a missing persons report. But unfortunately, the officers didn't take them seriously and, in a tale as old as time, told the worried parents that they had to wait at least 72 hours to report her missing. Frustrated by the lack of concern, Kenya's family didn't know what to do, but fortunately, Travis, the man from the text message, finally called back the next day. He politely explained to Tony that he had seen Kenya alone on the street outside the nightclub after midnight and offered her a ride home. The 31-year-old stated that she was clearly intoxicated and looked like she needed help, so he figured he'd do the noble thing and get her home safely. Plus, her address was super close to the bakery where he worked, so he said he knew the area well. But unfortunately, his good deed didn't go as planned. Travis continued, saying that Kenya asked if they could stop at a Conoco gas station on the way home so she could purchase cigarettes, but the store was closed when they arrived. However, he said that Kenya noticed another man, who he called Dan, standing outside smoking a cigarette and decided to join him. Travis remembered that the two had a short conversation in Spanish before eventually walking away together. Travis said this was the last time he saw Kenya. The conversation ended with Travis saying, "I wish I knew more about what happened to your daughter, but I told you everything I know." Still, Tony wasn't done asking questions just yet, and requested that Travis meet him in person at the Conoco gas station to talk further. The worried stepfather knew the police weren't going to help until 72 hours had passed, so he felt he had no other option but to take action. Tony was wary of Travis, so on his way out the door, he grabbed a 9mm handgun. However, when Kenya's mother, Maria, realized what was happening, she begged him not to go. Tony, however, told her that he had no choice and left without another word. When Tony arrived at the gas station, it was swarming with police cruisers. As it turned out, Maria had called 911 right after he left home and requested officers be present during the meeting in case things got out of hand. Regardless, Travis exited his white van and came over to speak with Tony, offering the exact same story he had given earlier. Tony thought Travis seemed like a genuine and trustworthy person, and he certainly didn't have the expected look of a psychotic killer. Still, Tony couldn't ignore the feeling that something just wasn't quite right, because it wasn't in Kenya's nature to wander off with a total stranger from a gas station in the middle of the night. The responding officers also took Travis aside for a few additional questions in private. While Travis was being questioned, Tony walked over to his white van and was immediately struck by the distinct odor of bleach. He immediately became suspicious of the smooth-talking stranger. Travis agreed to let Tony and the officers take a look inside his van, which was absolutely spotless in the back with brand new carpeting. In contrast, the front of the van was in complete disarray, with trash and personal belongings strewn everywhere. While it seemed a little odd, there really wasn't any reason to hold Travis, so they let him go after obtaining a formal statement. He insisted that he'd been at his girlfriend's house from 3 a.m. until 8 a.m. After that, he said he was making deliveries for Debbie's Bakery and Cafe, where he sold homemade gluten-free granola bars. Police contacted his girlfriend, who corroborated his alibi and said he'd been with her all night. Then, just as Tony was about to get into his car and leave the gas station, Travis approached him and started crying about how sorry he was and how he wished he had followed through on what he started. Tony thanked him for trying to help and extended his hand, but a chill ran up his spine when Travis shook his hand in return. Tony later stated that at that exact moment, he felt sure that Travis had been the last person to see his daughter alive, but his alibi still made it impossible for him to be involved. People who meet or interact with a psychopath often describe the same experience. They describe a chill up their spine or the hairs on the back of their neck standing on end. This reaction is part of our innate survival instinct. Thousands of years ago, we had to rely on our perceptions of people and situations to keep ourselves safe from harm. Nowadays, many of us dismiss the gut instincts we have about a dangerous person because we think we're being paranoid or just imagining things. But that intuition is there for a reason, and it's important to listen to it. It appears that Tony felt that gut instinct loud and clear when he came into closer contact with Travis. The official police investigation into Kenya's disappearance finally kicked off on April 4th, and it didn't take long for them to discover chilling surveillance footage from her night out. Apparently, Kenya had wandered away from the club with an unknown man to his apartment complex. The video, taken before Travis allegedly offered her a ride, showed Kenya stumbling into the apartment lobby before seemingly changing her mind and leaving alone. Some sources state that the man in the video is someone she met that night at 24K, but police thought he could potentially be linked to her disappearance. Meanwhile, Kenya's case had made national headlines, and her face was all over the news. Having been the last one seen with the missing woman, Travis seized the opportunity to clear his name and make it known that he wished he'd done things differently that fateful night.
I'm sorry that I was indifferent, that I didn't think anything. I didn't think she was gonna disappear. I could have intervened more, you know, and not just said okay and gone home, you know. You know, everybody has their own choices, you know, and she chose to walk off with this guy. And I can't blame myself for that. God, I'm sorry. This has been really emotional for me.
Still, as an extra precaution, police requested surveillance tapes from Debbie's Bakery and Cafe, where Travis worked, as he was really the only lead they had at the time. Investigators weren't expecting to see much of anything because Travis was supposedly out making deliveries all day. But what the tape actually caught made the hairs on the back of their necks stand up. On April 1st, Travis was caught on camera wheeling a large cooler sealed with duct tape into the bakery freezer. He was also seen wearing latex gloves while lugging a roll of carpet, multiple small towels, and a bottle of bleach before he decided to unplug the surveillance camera. The bakery owner came forward, eager to tell investigators that Travis was not even scheduled to work that day. She also stated that he had a large, noticeable cut on his arm, which he claimed was from being attacked by a homeless man. Finally, she informed them that when she asked Travis why he had turned off the security cameras, he claimed it was because he wanted to change his clothes. Suspicious, right? Detectives went around to neighboring businesses, hoping to glean more information. One person insisted that they had seen at least one man burning something in a large barrel behind the bakery next to a white van. Another said they witnessed Travis cleaning out a large cooler in the back of his van right after Kenya vanished. Travis attempted to explain the fire away by saying it was just moldy marijuana in the barrel. But hold on to your seat, because this is where the story takes a drastic turn. Investigators soon gained access to Travis's phone records, and they showed that he had been nowhere near his girlfriend's house on the night in question. In fact, he was in a rural town roughly 40 miles away from Denver. Detectives contacted his girlfriend once again, and as it turns out, Travis had asked her to lie about his whereabouts, and she agreed to protect him. Yikes. So, with all of this new information, it was time for investigators to learn a little more about the supposed Good Samaritan. As a teenager, Travis Forbes had been charged with breaking into 16 different homes and businesses in the Fort Collins area and stealing more than $15,000 in assets. Travis was eventually caught, and upon searching his room, police discovered three pairs of torn-up women's underwear, which he had marked with the letter M. He was charged with 2 counts of felony burglary, but instead of a prison sentence, Travis was sent to a military boot camp. However, he was kicked out after just 50 days in the program for several rule violations and placed on probation. While still on probation in 1998, Travis was arrested for criminal harassment. And then the following year, he was caught carrying a knife in public. Yet another rule break. Oh, and he also managed to break curfew a whopping 43 times in that short 2-year period. He was subsequently sent to community corrections, but that didn't stop his violent behavior. On the contrary, it actually seemed to intensify his cruelty towards women. For example, on July 17, 2004, he was arrested and charged with third-degree assault after pelting rocks at 2 female friends as they jogged in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. He spent 5 months in jail for that crime and claims to have had a change in spirituality while behind bars. Yeah, right. It's not uncommon for psychopaths to specifically target women. This occurs for a few reasons. For one, a female victim is often an easier target for a male psychopath because he can usually physically overpower her. Criminals tend to prefer an easier target, a target that will give them the reward or outcome they want with the least effort possible. Smart criminals also make an effort to avoid getting caught, so an easy target always minimizes the likelihood that the victim can escape or that they can otherwise be caught if the victim yells or fights back. Psychopaths don't see a woman or any human being as a person. Psychopaths and most people with APD see people as objects or things they can use to their convenience. They're highly impulsive, so if they have a need, they will use whoever and whatever means to satisfy that need. People with psychopathy have actual differences in brain functioning and brain structure compared to the brain of typical people, such as the regions that regulate our ability to control impulses and make good decisions. So, now that we know a little more about Travis, it should come as no surprise that in the weeks following Kenya's disappearance, he took his friend's car and fled to Austin, Texas. The bakery owner informed police that Travis had been mumbling about needing to change his name because that girl ruined my life. Travis was arrested on suspicion of auto theft in Austin on May 4th, and police interviewed him for 3 hours regarding Kenya's case. The lead detective later stated, "He just explained everything away. He had an excuse for everything, the barrel, the cooler, everything." Travis was eventually extradited back to Colorado, but he was released when his friend dropped the auto theft charges. So while Kenya's loved ones were desperately holding out hope for her safe return, Travis went to live with his father in Fort Collins, but investigators kept him under a close watch, or so they thought. Shortly after moving, Denver detectives witnessed a confrontation between a highly intoxicated Travis and the Fort Collins police, and they informed them of who Travis was and why they were surveilling him. However, Travis seemed to chill out for the next 3 days, so Denver police decided to end their watch over him, a decision that would later come back to haunt them all. That's because Travis would commit a heinous crime the very next day. He began following 30-year-old Lydia Tillman, who'd been walking home from a 4th of July fireworks display in downtown Fort Collins. Unfortunately, by the time the young woman realized she was being followed, it was too late. Travis forced her inside her apartment and viciously attacked her until she was barely alive before setting the entire apartment on fire. Miraculously, Lydia managed to escape the inferno by jumping out of a second-story window onto the concrete below. Paramedics raced to her side, but before she could describe her attacker fully, Lydia suffered a stroke and went into a coma, which she stayed in for 5 weeks. Investigators combed through Lydia's torched apartment, but quickly discovered that someone had first doused the entire place in bleach, thus eliminating any forensic evidence that may have been left behind. Fortunately, however, Lydia had fought hard for her life, and as a result, microscopic DNA was found under her fingernails. While investigators anxiously awaited the lab analysis results on the DNA, Authorities from Denver and Fort Collins touched base on their suspicions that the same person had been responsible for both Kenya's disappearance and Lydia's attack, Travis. They specifically honed in on the use of bleach, with one detective stating, "It sounds like him. He likes bleach. This is his thing." Authorities placed Travis back under constant surveillance, and on July 10th, he was spotted prowling the downtown area and leering at women. So when officers witnessed him walking off with a young woman, they knew they needed to intervene. They confronted a clearly nervous Travis and asked various questions about his identity. He claimed his last name was Kennedy, but said he couldn't remember his address and didn't have any form of identification. By the time officers were done speaking with Travis, the woman he'd been speaking with was gone, and they knew they had to let him go. However, when he returned just 20 minutes later wearing a hat and a new shirt and began stalking a different woman, he was arrested for providing a false name. Police took him into custody for the misdemeanor charge, but they knew it wouldn't be long before he posted bond and was back on the streets again. Then, just minutes before Travis was set to be released on bond, the results from the DNA test came back. The sample found under Lydia's fingernails was a match to Travis Forbes. He was immediately rebooked and held on suspicion of attempted murder, assault, and arson. It's not uncommon for a psychopath to commit another crime right after the initial one. It's possible that the stress of being watched, questioned, and pursued by police led Travis to seek out another victim. Psychopaths often commit horrific acts just out of the sheer pleasure of it, which works to alleviate any emotional stress they might have. Before interviewing Travis in jail, investigators worked tirelessly to ensure they also had an airtight case against him for Kenya's disappearance. They fully expected him to deny any involvement, but in yet another shocking twist, the cold-blooded criminal calmly told detectives, "I'll tell you everything, but I want a deal." Travis wanted prosecutors to agree to take the death penalty off the table and not label him a sex offender because, in his words, "If I go to prison as a sex offender, I'm f***." Finally, Travis confessed to what really happened the night Kenya vanished. He said that Kenya was alone outside the 24K nightclub, conversing with a homeless man when he decided to offer her a ride home. However, when Kenya passed out in his van, Travis saw it as an opportunity. He began assaulting her, but she woke up and started fighting back. So Travis killed her in cold blood. Then he put her body in the large cooler in his van and duct taped it shut before moving it to the freezer inside Debbie's Bakery and Cafe. He eventually buried Kenya's body in rural Keensburg. Travis then returned to clean his van and the cooler with bleach and burn anything Kenya might have touched in the large barrel, including her clothes. Finally, 5 long months after her disappearance, Travis led detectives to a shallow grave in a field under a cottonwood grove.
And you, how long do you think you dug for?
It wasn't very long. I was actually surprised. I was worried that it was so late that I wouldn't have enough time.
Okay.
But I dug that hole fast.
As he sobbed uncontrollably at the sight of her resting place, Travis insisted he hadn't intended to kill Kenya. However, that admission didn't quite align with a statement he made earlier about being a dangerously evil sociopath, or with the fact that he hinted at the possibility of other victims. It sounds like Travis has some awareness of his psychopathy, which is very rare, as usually a key feature of personality disorders is a lack of awareness. However, it does happen among severe psychopaths where they can accurately label their psychological problem, like Travis did. He didn't use the word psychopath, but he got the evil and dangerous parts right. Furthermore, Travis seemed to taunt the lead detective on the ride back from the place he buried Kenya by saying, "Are you happy, Nash? Are you happy you found her? Are you happy you got her back?" It's always strange and confusing when a psychopath shows a normal human emotion, like crying. They can move on very quickly from a moment of experiencing a sad emotion. Their ability to disconnect from or cut off emotions is part of what allows them to commit horrible crimes. A psychopath can sometimes experience and show certain emotions. Maybe while at the place where he buried Kenya, Travis felt some degree of regret. It's important to keep in mind that at this point, he already knows he's likely going to prison for the rest of his life. So the fact that he's sobbing uncontrollably could be at least partly influenced by his awareness of his fate. Travis Forbes was given a life sentence without parole for Kenya's murder and an additional 48 years for the attempted murder and assault of Lydia. Travis's girlfriend was also handed a short jail sentence and community service for obstruction of justice for lying to police about his alibi. A few short hours after emerging from a coma, Lydia courageously wrote her victim impact statement. While she couldn't read it herself due to the horrific nature of her injuries, the judge shared her letter with the court. It read, "Travis Forbes, you caused me no harm. My spirit, my soul, and my mind remain untouched. May you find peace in this life. It was my intention to find the strength in my heart to forgive Travis Forbes. I did. I felt extreme anger towards him, then I felt sad for him. He must be in so much extreme pain to so brutally hurt another human." On that note, let's move on to our next twisted true crime case. It started out as a typical day in Dallas, Texas in December 1990, but things took a gruesome turn when the heinously exposed body of a young woman was discovered in an undeveloped suburban neighborhood. The resident who found the body was so disturbed that they actually ran into their home and grabbed a floral bedsheet to cover the victim. The first responding officers immediately recognized their victim as 33-year-old Mary Lou Pratt, a veteran sex worker in the area. She'd been shot by a .44 caliber pistol and showed signs of an assault, but it was apparent to crime scene analysts that she had been killed elsewhere before being dumped in the middle of the road, where her body would be quickly found. Still, they weren't yet seeing the total brutality of the crime. Investigators were stumped. They had no witnesses, murder weapon, or motive, and very little forensic evidence. A few months passed, and then another sex worker turned up dead on the same street where Mary Lou's body had been dumped. The victim was identified as 27-year-old Susan Peterson, and she too had been shot several times and showed the same unique injuries as Mary Lou. Police actually withheld this graphic detail from the public at first, only disclosing that the victims had been strangely mutilated to maintain the integrity of the investigation. The following month, a third sex worker, 45-year-old Shirley Williams, was found deceased from gunshot wounds in the early morning hours. While she was in a different residential area than the others, not far from an elementary school, Shirley also experienced the same strange mutilation. At this point, law enforcement officers were urging sex workers to stay off the streets and practice caution, but they couldn't protect everyone from the evil lurking in the shadows. Desperate for any information, the Dallas police called an FBI profiler onto the case, and they generated a profile of the killer that stated they would likely have some sort of specialized training in either medicine or taxidermy based on the victim's injuries. More on that little detail later. They also predicted that the perpetrator was a fit white male in his 30s, as he was able to overpower strong women. Still, detectives had virtually no leads or sense of direction in the case. But that was about to change. Officers working the case suddenly remembered a strange encounter from about 2.5 months before Mary Lou's murder. They were out patrolling a part of the city known to be frequented by sex workers when they were approached by a woman named Veronica Rodriguez, who frequented that particular street. The officers immediately noticed a deep cut on her face and neck, and when they asked what happened, Veronica exclaimed, "I almost got killed." Veronica explained that a man had picked her up the previous night and drove her to an isolated field, where she was violently assaulted. However, she managed to escape and run to a nearby home, which happened to be owned by a man she knew. Veronica described her attacker as a white male, but that was all she could recall from the terrifying ordeal. Unfortunately, Veronica was known around town for allegedly telling elaborate lies to the police, so they didn't initially take her story seriously. But 2 days later, they saw her riding alongside a man in the cab of an 18-wheeler truck and pulled them over to ask a few more questions. The man driving the truck was identified as Axton Schindler, and Veronica insisted that he had been the one to save her life that night. Axton informed the officers that he lived at 1035 El Dorado, located in the same Oak Cliff neighborhood where Mary Lou and Susan had been found. However, he denied knowing anything about a supposed attack against Veronica, so the officers assumed the story was just another one of her attempts to seek pity from them and arrested her for prostitution. They also took Axton downtown for several unpaid parking tickets and decided to put the whole thing to rest. Only after the three murders took place would they realize this had been a significant clue left behind by a ruthless predator. As the officers continued to canvass the streets, they encountered a sex worker named Brenda White, who had quite the story to tell. She claimed to have been attacked the previous night by a white man with salt and pepper hair, who said, "I hate I'm going to kill all you mother-. Brenda told police that she maced him and jumped out of the moving car to escape. Officers were beginning to connect the dots between Veronica and Brenda's accounts and the recent killings. Both women had been picked up from the same area and violently attacked by a man who seemed to loathe sex workers. As a result, authorities decided to take another look at Axton Schindler, as the address he offered was so close to the crime scenes. It didn't take long for them to realize that the address he had given them actually didn't belong to him at all. Instead, the property was listed under Frederick Albright, who owned multiple other properties close to where Mary Lou and Susan's bodies were discovered. Detectives thought they were really onto something, but there was one big problem. Frederick Albright had passed away several years earlier. Still, one of the investigators couldn't shake the feeling that they had heard that name before. Then they recalled a tip received from one of Mary Lou Pratt's friends following her murder about a 58-year-old man named Charles Albright, the son of Frederick Albright. The friend stated that Mary Lou and Charles had briefly dated, and while she described him as pleasant, she also noted that he had a strange obsession with eyes and kept a collection of X-Acto blades in his home. So naturally, officers were eager to run a background check on Charles, and they soon learned that he was the one who lived at 1035 El Dorado in the Oak Cliff neighborhood, not Axton. Police later learned that Axton rented a different home from Charles and had lied about his address because he was paranoid and liked to keep his privacy from the government. It was truly just a bizarre coincidence. Moreover, they found out that Charles had a criminal record that included theft, burglary, and forgery charges. Detectives pulled his mugshot and found that Charles matched the vague witness descriptions. Then they showed a photo lineup to Brenda and Veronica, and when both women identified Charles Albright as their attacker, police knew they had enough evidence to make an arrest. So on March 22, 1991, officers arrived at 1035 El Dorado in the middle of the night and took Charles into custody. Now, there's a significant piece of information that I haven't told you yet, but be warned that this stunning detail is very graphic, and your discretion is advised. During Mary Lou's autopsy, Dr. Elizabeth Peacock, the pathologist performing the external exam, made a shocking discovery. As she pulled back the eyelids to verify the victim's eye color, she stopped and exclaimed, "My God, they're gone." Yes, both of Mary Lou's eyeballs had been removed, and with such precision, there was no damage to the surrounding tissue or lids. The work appeared to have been that of a skilled surgeon or someone experienced in taxidermy. Oh, but Mary Lou wasn't the only one to suffer this horrific fate. Susan Peterson and Shirley Williams were also found to be missing their eyes. The Dallas police contacted the FBI's Violent Crimes Apprehension Program unit to see if they had ever encountered such a surgically precise form of mutilation, and they had not. So, given that information, investigators knew that they were looking for a depraved killer with a bizarre fixation on eyeballs, and they believed they had finally found him. Charles Albright had been adopted as an infant and was said to be an academically gifted child. He excelled in school and even learned to speak several other languages at a young age. Charles was also reportedly quite the prankster, who enjoyed the company of his friends. However, while overprotective at times, his mother would often inflict cruel punishments on him for even small mistakes, including forcing him to dress in girls' clothing. As he got a little older and earned his first rifle, Charles showed an interest in shooting small animals, so his parents enrolled him in a taxidermy course. As with most things he attempted, Charles mastered the art, but instead of using expensive glass eyes to finish each project, his mother would only allow him enough money to use creepy old buttons. Charles graduated high school at just 15 years old, and eager to escape his mother's watchful eye, he quickly enrolled at North Texas State College. However, he was expelled after being arrested for participating in a student burglary ring during his first year. While he denied his involvement, Charles ultimately served 1 year in prison. Following his release, Charles enrolled in college, where he seemed to thrive academically as well as socially. It was here that he also met his future wife, an English major named Betty Hester. However, during his time at college, his harmless pranks started turning into real crimes, and he was eventually kicked out for stealing college property. But even that didn't stop him. Before leaving, Charles stole blank transcript forms that he filled out to use as proof of credentials for future jobs, and it worked. He was hired as a teacher and football coach at a high school in Dallas, and by all accounts, he was very well liked among both students and colleagues. Still, his criminal past eventually caught up with him, and after being charged with fraud, he was fired and given 1 year of probation. Charles's history, beginning in his adolescent years, definitely matches the profile of a person with APD. However, it's important to note that the people involved in this case haven't been formally diagnosed with any mental illness, and the psychological analysis is not based upon a formal assessment. The fact that he was highly intelligent makes him all the more dangerous, because this means he can execute crimes more carefully. His early involvement with pranks that later escalated to committing crimes shows the early signs of a lack of moral conscience and disregard for social rules. It seems he was likely charismatic, another APD trait that makes him even more dangerous because he can easily fool people, gain trust, and more easily draw in potential victims. The fact that his mother used to inflict severe punishments on him, including making him dress in girls' clothing, shows that Charles likely suffered severe psychological trauma, which could have contributed to the development of APD. He might have developed an intense hatred for females because he hated the female clothing he was forced to wear. A child who develops this sort of trauma won't necessarily grow up to murder women, but this may have at least contributed to Charles' emotional issues. Having to use buttons instead of glass eyes because his mother would not give him the money could partly explain his obsession with eyeballs. At this point, Charles was bouncing from one career to another, and his list of hobbies was just as long, but he became best known as an accomplished artist painting portraits for money. On one occasion, a friend had asked him to paint a portrait of his wife, and after months went by, the friend went to Charles's house to request that he get his money back. However, when he arrived, he found an incredible 6-foot by 3-foot portrait of his wife, complete except for one thing. 2 gaping wide holes were left in place of her eyes. When the friend asked Charles about finishing the eyes, he responded that he would when he was ready. Charles completed the portrait a few months later, and the friend recalled that he painted the eyes so perfectly that they seemed to follow you across the room. Betty ultimately divorced Charles in 1975, and this decision seemed to spark a whole new twisted chapter in his life. He began dating many women at a time and seeing sex workers regularly enough to earn their trust. Charles had actually been listed as Susan Peterson's contact at the bail bond office, and he knew Mary Lou Pratt before she even got into the industry because they lived near each other. Continuing his downward spiral in 1980, Charles spent 6 months in prison for stealing a saw from a local repair store, and then in 1985, he was accused of assaulting a 14-year-old girl. Despite swearing he hadn't done anything, Charles pled guilty to knowingly and intentionally engaging in deviant acts with an individual under age 14 and was placed on probation again. Psychopaths often spiral as a result of a major life stressor. Their manner of coping is often to take out their anger and inner desire for control over others by victimizing innocent people. Victimizing another person is, after all, the ultimate show of control. By this time, Charles had become an expert at hiding his dark side, and he soon won over a woman named Dixie, who claimed that he was nothing but kind and gentle towards her. However, little did she know that Charles was growing more aggressive and violent during his regular visits with sex workers, and many stopped seeing him altogether as a result. Charles inherited his father's properties in the South Dallas area in 1986 and moved into 1035 El Dorado with Dixie. When later asked why he kept the properties under his father's name, Charles said it was for sentimental reasons. How very convenient. Most of the time, Dixie had no clue what he was up to because Charles started a job delivering newspapers, which allowed him to be out on the streets in the dark early morning hours. So, now that we know more about Charles' backstory, it should come as no surprise that police stumbled upon some pretty sketchy stuff while searching his home. Beyond the casual collection of taxidermied animals, they also found blades and razors all over his home, even some hidden in the walls. But the most damning pieces of evidence were the hundreds of photographs of women's eyes he kept along with the newspaper clippings of the recent murders. The only thing the police failed to locate was forensic evidence linking him to the crimes, including the specific murder weapons and the women's missing eyeballs. Investigators were also determined to find the yellow raincoat Shirley Williams had supposedly been wearing when she disappeared. It wasn't in Charles's home, so they went to the field where Veronica said she'd been attacked, and there they found the missing jacket under a pile of brush. It was coated in blood, which DNA tests would later reveal belonged to Shirley, but a few hairs and other fibers were left behind that didn't belong to the victim. While the hairs no longer contained any usable DNA for testing, they did appear similar to Charles's under a microscope, and the other fibers matched a blanket found in his truck. All the while, Charles adamantly maintained his innocence. When asked what kind of person could be capable of cutting out the eyes of another human, Charles calmly replied, "Someone who is sadistic? Just one mean son of a gun. I don't know the purpose behind it unless that person thought the women wouldn't be able to see without their eyes in the next world, which is sort of ignorant. Psychopaths who are intelligent and smooth-talking are truly the worst kind of predator because they have enough social skills to draw people in and gain their trust. Here are a few warning signs of this type of dangerous predator. Having a short fuse. They might come off as funny and easygoing, but after spending some time with them, you'll likely notice how they can quickly go from being calm and kind to angry and aggressive from 0 to 100. Then, you might notice that they'll just as quickly calm down after becoming angry as if nothing happened. They will charismatically make fun of, mistreat, or bully others. The charismatic psychopath will often say something mean or belittling to the people around them. Sometimes, these mean and belittling comments are made with humor. The comments often come out of nowhere. Psychopaths treat others this way because they have a need to exert control and dominance over others, and they also just enjoy being cruel. They make promises that they think you want to hear. Smart psychopaths are good at analyzing people and getting a feel for a person's weaknesses, needs, and desires. They use this information to inflict control over others and to manipulate others for their own benefit. A psychopath often makes false promises in order to make you trust them and to satisfy you in the moment. If they know there's something you like or want, they will promise to do it for you or get it for you because they know that this will appease you in the moment. Despite the lack of evidence, prosecutors decided to take the risk and charge Charles with all three murders. His trial began in December 1991, with his defense arguing that there was virtually nothing linking their client to the slayings. Still, the circumstantial evidence was enough to sway the jury, at least in one of the cases. While Charles was acquitted for the murders of Mary Lou Pratt and Susan Peterson, he was found guilty in the case of Shirley Williams and sentenced to life in prison, where he passed away in 2020. All right, it's time for the last true crime case, and believe me, this one has a dramatic twist that no one saw coming. Our story begins at the end of April 2015 on a dusty back road in Monroe County, Missouri. A local man named Glenn McSparn was taking a shortcut home when he noticed a car pulled off to the side of the road. He didn't think much of it until he saw something on the ground near the front tires that made his blood run cold. Illuminated by his truck's headlights, Glenn caught a glimpse of a woman's body lying in the gravel road. He later stated, "When I saw her, I swear my heart stopped. I could tell she wasn't moving. I looked in her eyes and I could tell that she was gone." Glenn dialed 911 immediately. Authorities descended on the scene, and after checking the vehicle registration, they discovered their victim's identity. It was 35-year-old Molly Watson, and she'd been shot once at close range in the back of the head. Inside her car, police found a marriage license on the passenger seat and were shocked to learn that she was due to be wed in less than 48 hours. Though her cell phone seemed to be missing from the scene, Molly was still wearing her engagement ring and had cash in her wallet when she was found. So investigators were able to rule out a robbery gone wrong. But if that wasn't the motive, what was? After all, Molly was a kind and bubbly person without an enemy in the world. So it seemed unfathomable that anyone would want her dead. Now, instead of simply explaining to you who Molly Watson was, I figured it would be best just to let her tell you herself.
Hi everybody, it's Molly, and today I am just kind of doing a general vlog. I figured I would just kind of give a little bit of background on me. I am 34. I work in education right now. I have 2 degrees in psychology, a bachelor's and a master's. I'm working on a third degree, a second master's in counseling. And I am very much a huge geek. I hate being called a nerd. I am what was formerly known as Asperger's syndrome. Now they refer to it as high functioning autism. I don't particularly care for the change. They did it to more attempt to remove the stigma from autism, which is a great idea, but ended up only further stigmatizing those of us that have Asperger's. That said, I also have various skills. I like to do crafty stuff, prop making. This is part of a prop I'm working on. I have 5 cats. That's all I got.
In a surreal twist of fate, Molly's loved ones were now gathering for her funeral rather than her wedding. According to friends and family, the bride-to-be had been ecstatic about the upcoming nuptials and even purchased 2 different wedding dresses for the occasion. After all, she was set to marry the man of her dreams, a 51-year-old prison lieutenant named James Addy. Molly had been married when she was younger, and while that ended in divorce, the two shared a son whom Molly reportedly loved more than anything. Then, after a few other failed relationships, Molly met James while working at a correctional center. The two were head over heels for each other, and their relationship quickly became serious. James Addy was a veteran of the United States Marines and a devoted father of 2. While he had been married 4 times before, those close noticed something different about his relationship with Molly. It was as though they were destined to be together. The couple dated for 7 years before deciding to tie the knot, and Molly began excitedly planning a big Disney-themed wedding. James was much quieter and more reserved with his emotions, but that's part of what Molly loved about him. The wedding planner remarked that he was just a groom along for the ride. However, the couple's happiness was soon shattered by some devastating news. James's ex-wife and the mother of his 2 children, Melanie Addy, had recently been in a car accident, and she tragically passed away after being removed from life support. As a result, James had to put wedding planning on the back burner to handle funeral arrangements with his children, while Molly carried on with most of the preparations herself. So on April 25th, 2018, just 2 days before her murder, Molly and James went to the Randolph County Clerk's office to apply for a marriage license. Security footage actually captured Molly smiling and laughing through most of the visit, while James was reportedly perturbed by some of the questions regarding his past relationships. Yet the pair looked perfectly happy as they walked out of the office hand in hand. That leads us to April 27th, 2018, the day Molly was murdered. James began the morning by dropping off decorations and centerpieces at the venue, and he made a payment to the wedding planner. It seemed like just any other day, but a living nightmare was right around the corner. Later that night, Glenn McSparren, the 911 caller, made the bone-chilling discovery. But not until after he came into contact with an older white man driving a big grandma car. He stated that the man's car was directly in front of Molly's vehicle, and when he shouted out to ask if they were stuck, the man told Glenn, "I don't know where they're at. It's going to be a while." Glenn turned around and left, but the more he thought about the encounter, the more it just didn't feel right, so he decided to go back. That's when he found Molly's lifeless body and called the police. Investigators at the crime scene were able to find clear tire track evidence from the unknown vehicle. A deputy also stumbled upon a discarded t-shirt on the side of the road that contained traces of both Molly's blood and gunshot residue. Unfortunately, they couldn't determine the exact murder weapon because the bullet removed from Molly's body was too mangled. Officers arrived at James Addy's home in the early morning hours to deliver the heartbreaking news of his fiancée's murder. However, when he answered the door, they made a shocking discovery that would turn the entire investigation upside down. A woman came up behind James as police were standing in the doorway and identified herself as Melanie Addy. Yes, that's James's ex-wife, who had supposedly just died from a car crash. Melanie had heard everything and claimed that she had no idea who Molly was, so James was forced to come clean right then and there. To Melanie's complete shock and horror, he confessed to having been involved in a 7-year affair with the murder victim. According to friends and family, Molly was under the impression that James had divorced Melanie before she supposedly tragically died and was completely unaware of his second life. Upon questioning, James, who looked clearly nervous, told investigators that he had left home that night to pick up an avocado plant, but arrived back at around 8:30. Melanie informed police that she awoke sometime in the middle of the night to James snoring beside her. James also stated that he had communicated with Molly earlier in the evening using a second phone behind Melanie's back. Detectives quickly searched his device on the spot and found several messages sent from James to Molly after her death, including one reading, "I love you so much." Given all this startling new information and James's guilty disposition, police placed him under arrest on suspicion of first-degree murder. Meanwhile, detectives started to build their case against him. They looked into Molly's social media history and found a disturbing post she made several years earlier about an ex trying to break into her bank accounts. She wrote, "I suspect it was the unstable individual who attempted to intimidate me with their service weapon by pointing it at me and threatening me when I left the relationship." Many believe this was written about James, as they had broken up and gotten back together several times in their 7 years together. Furthermore, information from Molly's phone showed that she had been talking to James as she drove to the location of her murder. Her records also revealed that she'd been researching Melanie Addy's obituary the day before the murder, indicating that she may have learned that their relationship was actually an affair just before their intended wedding. Psychopaths will do just about anything to avoid being exposed, because once they are exposed, they can no longer manipulate the people in their lives. Molly might have threatened to expose James to his wife and children. He probably knew he had to do whatever he needed to in order to stop Molly from doing something that could potentially ruin his life. When a situation like this occurs, a psychopath will choose themselves first, even if it means harming a loved one. Oh, but James's two cell phones had an even more shocking story to tell, as he had been messaging himself back and forth that day. He was sending messages from one of his phones to the other that almost seemed like he was hyping himself up to do something. For example, one text read, "Let's go, man." James Addy's trial began in April 2021, with the prosecution alleging that he had deliberately killed Molly that night after she confronted him about his marriage to Melanie. In their opening argument, the prosecutor told the court that James had decided it was time to choose between his two lives. On the other hand, his defense argued that the timeline didn't add up, based on when his wife claimed to have heard him come back home, and that based on that knowledge, James couldn't be held responsible for Molly's death beyond a reasonable doubt. Some of the evidence presented at court came from an unlikely source. James's daughter testified that she had met Molly, but had no knowledge of a romantic relationship between the two. She also identified the t-shirt found near the scene as one she had made for her father. Another one of the key pieces of evidence was the tire tracks left behind at the crime scene. And while the prosecution called in an expert who claimed they were an exact match to James's car, the defense argued their testing methods were faulty. But that wasn't all the prosecution had against James. They also called the wedding planner to the stand, and she recalled that after their meeting on that fateful day, James had remarked on his way out that Molly was driving him crazy. Then, as their final effort, prosecutors introduced two inmates who made separate statements regarding things James had said in jail while awaiting trial. According to the inmates, James admitted to laying someone face down in a ditch. While James continued to maintain his innocence and the defense made a compelling argument, the verdict spoke for itself. James Addy was convicted of first-degree murder and armed criminal action. In July 2021, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole plus 10 years. It's strange that for 7 years, Molly didn't realize that James was married. Sometimes, however, people in relationships will ignore certain red flags. In Molly's case, she likely saw red flags right away, but she ignored them and continued with the relationship. The more time goes by, the more emotionally attached you'll get, and the harder it will be to reason and think logically if something feels off about the person you're dating. It's true that love can blind people. It's possible that Molly felt that James was lying several times throughout their relationship, but maybe he made up stories and excuses to convince her. James has not been formally diagnosed with any mental illness that we're aware of, and the aforementioned analysis is based on a general analysis of people exhibiting these traits and behaviors. Psychopaths engage in excuse-making and storytelling in order to manipulate the people in their lives. Their stories are often very convincing. But even when their victims sense a lie, the psychopath will manipulate them into doubting their own judgment, i.e. gaslighting, by calling them crazy, paranoid, sensitive, or tell them they're exaggerating. If a person seems to be always making up excuses, and you find that you're always giving them the benefit of the doubt, take this as a definite big red flag. It's fine to give someone the benefit of the doubt a couple of times, but more than a couple of times means that there's something wrong. If a person you're dating minimizes your feelings or tries to convince you that you're crazy or overreacting when you call them out on their behaviors, this is a definite red flag. Know who you're dating. If the person has violent or aggressive tendencies, avoid assuming that they would never do it to you. It's very likely that James had some issues with violence and aggression. Remember that it takes a psychopath to commit a murder in cold blood, the way that Molly was murdered. A typical, well-adjusted person doesn't just get up one day and decide to become a murderer. People who murder typically show behavioral issues in their daily lives. These behavioral issues usually include poor anger control, physical violence towards others, impulsivity, rule-breaking behaviors, and/or alcohol or substance use.